You are listening to Media Geek, your weekly look at the world of grassroots and independent media, as well as a critical examination of our media environment. My name is Paul Rees-Manel, and I am your host. And you can check out Media Geek online at mediageek.net, home to the Media Geek blog, which, John, I must say, has been way more updated as of late.
Yes, it has. You've been kicking my butt, actually.
I've been getting back on the stick, trying to get at least a few posts a week. Bringing up some issues and things that just aren't time for on the program. That's at mediageek.net. And the radio program's at radio.mediageek.net, where you can download or you get the podcast. You can listen in your browser. Catch things that you may not have caught before in case you missed a program or you want to hear it again, all at radio.mediageek.net. If you have any comments about the program, send it to me, paul@mediageek.net. And Twitter. I got the Twitter. It's nice tweeting about things that I do the show on, actually, and that's at. So if you do the Twitter and you're looking for folks to follow, go to twitter.com/MediaGeek or in Twitter speak at Media Geek. And I do want to say hello to a listener who goes by Daddy Mac Rant, who. One of the first, in fact, he's the first listener to actually catch up with me on the Twitter and let me know about it. So
yeah,
he gets a shout out, Daddy Mac Rant. Thanks for tweeting there. All online stuff, trying to take Media Geek Web 2.0 slowly but surely.
And I'm still trying to avoid Web 2.0 with all my might.
Yes, there is no Web 2.0 at DIYmedia.net.
Straight HTML. I really need to get a 21st century website going.
Well, and you are listening to WNUR FM in Evanston and Chicago. Chicago's Sound Experiment at 89.3 FM. And so, John... one of the things that you keep a very close eye on, and you seem to be one of the only folks, especially you are the only folk person who publishes it on the internet, your research here, is the FCC's enforcement on unlicensed broadcasting. And you've just completed a big update, looking back. I don't know when the last update you completed was.
August.
So you're catching up, and now you have statistics on the FCC's enforcement actions against people who are broadcasting primarily on the AM and FM dials without a license, although I guess in some other in other dials that are shortwave or television as well. And
and there's also been an increase in unlicensed broadcasting on land, mobile, maritime, aviation, and public safety frequencies.
Oh, interesting. So these are frequencies which are used for two-way communications primarily, and where broadcasting, meaning just monopolizing and sending out a signal like a radio station, is illegal altogether, never permissible,
right.
And never authorized license.
If you're messing with, say, a COP frequency, or you have an emergency distress beacon on your plane, which inadvertently activates, the Coast Guard has to mobilize to find you because they think you've crashed. You cause a lot of problems
that
way.
Yeah, it's sort of like calling 911.
I just was looking up a case last night, I think, from North Carolina of a guy who used to provide the radio services for the school district in the area, their school buses.
Mm-hmm.
He was the one who supplied the equipment and maintained it and everything, and he lost the contract to a competitor. So he started jamming the school bus frequencies out of spite. You know,
I would say that wasn't wise.
You know, no, of course not. I mean, that's dangerous. That's actual, actual potential harm right there. And the FCC went and visited him. They found the equipment. He showed him that handheld unit he was using to bust in on the frequencies, and they dinged him, I think, for something like $12,000. So, I don't really focus on all of the unlicensed broadcasts taking place.
Right.
For example, there was a case this year of a station whose license expired like in February, and it was still on the air in June. And technically, the FCC dinged that station for being a pirate radio station, but I don't consider that necessary unlicensed because they had a license, they just let it lapse.
Uh-huh.
I'm talking about the people who actually put up FM transmitters or AM transmitters or shortwave transmitters without any approval and broadcast in contravention of Section 301 of the Communications Act. And the FCC as I wrote in my summary, paper beats rock scissors. It's basically how the war on pirates is breaking down right now. They've only posted data through the middle of December, so there's probably still some stuff left to be posted over the next week or two. But right now, as of now, in 2008, there have been 389 enforcement actions. In 2007, for the year, there were 391. So chances are there's going to be a couple of pieces of random enforcement actions that have taken place between, say, December 16th and December 31st. And if we add those in, we're going to see the FCC probably meet and possibly beat its enforcement action activity record year over year. But it's not like a banner year or a record-setting year, nor should it be anything that people should be worried about. Because the methodology of the enforcement, the location of the enforcement, and the actual implications of being caught have not changed very much.
So when you say people shouldn't be worried, you mean anyone who is considering broadcasting without a license on the radio
dials? Right. I mean, my philosophy is you must assess your own relative risk. What is the risk that you are willing to accept in order to break this law? And how far are you willing to take breaking the law if and or when the FCC comes for you? If you look at the information and you look at the way the FCC acts when it comes to busting pirates, not only is it a victimless crime, but it's also one that the perpetrator usually gets off with nothing more than a certified letter.
Right.
You know, there's a couple of things popped out at me immediately when I was going through the data. The first one was that FCC enforcement right now is concentrated around very specific geographic areas. As it stands right now, Miami and the Miami-Dade Metroplex is still the hot spot for pirates. The FCC down there woke up in September and just went on a tear. And sent out a lot of letters and things like that. In fact, the local police busted a radio station, arrested the guy, and confiscated his equipment. And the next day, the FCC sent him a certified letter warning him of running a pirate radio station. You know, I mean, they're kind of on the ball, but not quite. You know what I'm saying?
I think there's a blues song in there somewhere. Did his wife leave him and his truck got stolen?
Yeah, you know. Secondly, the number two place in the area for radio piracy is New York City and the surrounding the metropolitan area. So if you included, say, like New Jersey's enforcement action with New York, that would top Miami. But first, as far as a single location goes, a single city goes, Miami's still on top, followed by New York. And those are really the top two. After that, things drop off dramatically. That being said, the fact that if you look at the 2008 enforcement action statistics, which I have online, and I actually map them. So anytime there's an enforcement action that takes place in a state, I color that state in. And if you look at the state map, it pretty much covers coast to coast. So even though the majority of FCC enforcement actions are taking place in specific hotspot areas, the fact that pirate radio exists around the country and all FCC field agents are making some sort of effort to deal with it leads me to the conclusion that pirate radio is still definitely a nationwide phenomenon. That's probably the biggest conclusion that I discovered from, you know, putting this data together. The third thing that I found was that there seems to be a trend in the timing of enforcement actions. I have a whole chart that lists every single enforcement action, when they visited a station, when they sent a warning letter, when they sent a notice of apparent liability, when they raided somebody, when they fined somebody, whatever, right? And if you, it looks to be that the FCC, like there's a mandate from DC that says, you know, spend some time hunting pirates to show that we care. And then the field agents every month in their calendar mark out a day or two, and that's the day that they go and resolve the complaints that they've collected over the last few months, right? So, like, September 11th, for example, was a big pirate hunting day in Florida, in Detroit, in New York, in Massachusetts, right? Similar day in October. You know, the agents are going out and they're doing it in a somewhat coordinated fashion. They've all picked roughly the same day or the same week to go out and actually do their pirate hunting business, and then they put it aside. So that's one thing that I noticed that was pretty interesting that I haven't seen before, is that multiple field offices are often active on the same day. I don't think that this has anything to do with trying to increase the efficacy of fighting pirate radio, because it's not like they're going out and raiding, you know, 1,000 stations in a day and taking them off the air. They just all happen to be driving around with their clipboards that day.
Right, right.
See what I'm saying? But there is some sort of rudimentary coordination like that, which is happening, that I haven't seen in any prior year.
Mm-hmm.
And I haven't looked closely at like 2007, 2006, when they really started increasing the administrative function of their enforcement. But I don't remember seeing this before. So that's a new piece of information. And then finally, the primary tools that the FCC is using to bust pirates, and I'll put bust in quotes, remains almost wholly administrative. Station visits and threatening sounding certified letters basically are the field agent's ammunition of choice. It's worth noting that although monetary forfeitures almost doubled this year, like the number of fines given out have almost doubled over the last year, it's still no larger than they were issuing in 2006. And we know that the rate of collection on those fines is abysmal. And if you were to take the number of fines issued by the FCC from when I started collecting data on this, which was 1997, and you add it all up and you divide it by the number of enforcement actions, you get a number which I call the FCC's expected recoupment. So for every enforcement action, they expect to make X number of dollars. It's essentially an average. And that average is like $374 per enforcement action. Now,
that's a speeding ticket.
Yeah, but that doesn't even count the cost of actually conducting the enforcement action, the labor cost, the material cost, and things like that. What I'm basically saying is, even under the best case scenario, if the FCC were to collect all of the money that it fines radio pirates for, which we know it does not, it collects possibly one quarter to one third of that money, if and I'm giving them the benefit of the doubt there, even if they were to collect that money, it would not be enough to pay off the cost of going after pirates.
Right.
Hunting pirates is a net money loser for the FCC.
Well, most things are net money loser for a regulatory agency.
Absolutely. And so, you know, if you boil it all down and you look at these pieces of data, and the other thing is that, you know, the state laws when it comes to, you know, criminalizing pirate radio in Florida and New Jersey, no change in the number of arrests or convictions. There were 4 this year. There were 4 last year. It's really making a dent.
Even though there were in the neighborhood of 100 different pirate operators in each state.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I mean, and the most they can get is 4. I mean, obviously, this is not a law that the local or state authorities in said states are really interested in enforcing, right? So, and they're not. The war on pirates has not trickled down to state and local police.
Yeah.
The FCC wouldn't mind. Florida broadcasters certainly wouldn't mind. New Jersey's broadcasters certainly wouldn't mind. But it ain't happening, is what I'm saying. Mm-hmm. Those laws are relatively toothless, and they're not being used. And so the conclusion that I get out of 2008 is that 2009 is going to be a year of opportunity for unlicensed broadcasters. Without some sort of massive infusion of human resources, capital, and political will, the FCC has plateaued on its ability to go after pirates. It simply doesn't have the strength to shut much of anything down. It has reached its enforcement capacity. This is the best they can get.
It's sending out a bunch of letters, basically.
Without some sort of massive institutional reorganization and reprioritization of pirate radio as a top thing, there is no way the FCC can shut much of anything down. And in that case, we, meaning the unlicensed broadcast community, are winning, and we're winning big.
Well, and the reason why we talk about
this—that's a good sign.
Yeah, the reason why we talk about this and we even care is that this is the crack in the pavement here, in what has become the extreme mollification of the radio dial, you know, with the Clear Channels and the CBS radios of the world. The limited voice of the community, you know, the essential, you know, mom and pop restaurant or corner store is unfortunately gone. And a few places that these local voices pop up any longer is in pirate radio. And you do have communities which are lucky enough to have licensed community stations or low power FM stations, which were created in part to help stem the tide of unlicensed broadcasting.
But you can't put LPFM stations in New York or Miami.
But you can't put them in, and you can't put them in most places in New Jersey, right? So you have these places where the ability for minority and immigrant communities to get on the air, or simply for a community-based broadcasting, something which might actually attend to the needs of Brooklyn or Queens or the Bronx or Staten Island, and not merely to the entire New York Metroplex, is absolutely impossible except to go on the air unlicensed. And this is true across the country. And this is why we pay attention to it, because it's you know, there's still the promise of radio, which is an inherently local medium, and it is not dead and is useful. And if people have left radio, if people have quit listening, if people have quit using it, it's because radio has ceased to attend to their needs, be it as in their local community, be it their artistic druthers, be it the information that they need. And in many communities, pirate radio stations come up to fill that. And not always, you know, like the rest of the radio dial, not always is every pirate radio station the best example of broadcasting. And not every case is a station truly attending to the grassroots or attending to forgotten art or to, overlooked communities. But in many cases,
technical parameters that are required to run a clean FM radio station.
Right. But but pirate radio is a response to the monopolization, the oligopoly of a small number of players running the radio dials across the country by regulatory fiat, we might add, by congressional fiat.
Yep.
Leaving, very few places for a community to have a voice. And we see that the FCC is statutorily required to enforce and to take these folks off the air. And what you're finding is that they have the ability to send you a lot of threatening letters, but their ability to really follow through on the threats and in a way in which you will be beholden by a court to have to pay up is nearly non-existent. And I wonder if part of that is, I mean, it's interesting that the amount of it seems the amount of enforcement actions has gone up by quite a bit, but we were not hearing about some of the more high profile actions that we heard about in the late part of the 90s, early part of the 2000s, where federal marshals were called in, where it is someplace like Austin, Texas, or in San Francisco Liberation Radio. We're not seeing that. It seems like pirate radio isn't really making the headlines in newspapers as much.
There are two things I would say to that. The first one is a caveat. Yes, the FCC has conducted 389 enforcement actions. That does not mean that the FCC has contacted 389 radio stations.
Okay.
Because I count an enforcement action. So, for example, a typical FCC enforcement involves a visit to the radio station and then a follow-up certified letter. I count each one of those as a separate enforcement action because they occur on separate days, right? So one line is a visit, one line is a certified letter. And in some cases, the FCC will make multiple visits, and in some cases, the FCC will send multiple letters to the same pirate station. Like, for example, a lot of times in Florida, not only will they track the signal down, they will track it down to a specific apartment in a building. They'll send a letter to that apartment, but they'll also send a letter to the building owner trying to scare the building owner into kicking that pirate off the air for them, right? All of these count as enforcement actions, which inflates the perceived efficacy of the FCC's ability to fight a war on pirates. So just as a little thought experiment of my own, take that number, 389, and effectively divide it by about 3. Okay, Because if you, mm-hmm. if you consider, like, all of the multiple enforcement actions that get done against one radio station and things like that, and the ones that don't, and you kind of put them all together, you could say, on average, just a ballpark, that there are 3 enforcement actions per station, roughly, okay? So if you divide 389 by 3, you get 127 or 129, mm-hmm. right? 129... for all of this year's work, 129 stations have been dimed and have appeared on the FCC's radar.
But that's just
now, the way I look at that.
Appears on their radar, right? That's just a letter saying we know you're there, we know you exist,
yes,
or we think you're there, we think you exist.
Yes, yes. Now, my theory to that is if the number of enforcement actions are going up, it's not only due to the fact that the FCC has invented crazy administrative wiggling ways by which they can go about inflating their numbers, but it's also indicative of the fact that there are lots of pirates on the air.
Exactly.
And the fact that enforcement actions are rising, I believe, correlates to a conclusion that is not out of bounds to make, that the number of pirates on the air is rising.
Mm-hmm.
If I were to put the number, if I were to guess, if someone had asked me, and actually somebody did for a paper they were working on, a friend of mine out in California that works for Freak Radio Santa Cruz actually is taking a journalism class. She was writing on radio pirates, and she's like, what would you estimate the number of pirates to be in the world, and what would you estimate the pirates to be in the United States? And I said, I can't give you a global estimate because I'm not keeping that sort of data. But as far as from what I can see from the enforcement side of things, there are well over 1,000 pirate radio stations on the air in the United States right now. And that is a number that back in the late 90s, as you were talking about, when we had the micro radio movement, so to speak, pre-LPFM, that was a number that they were floating around as being the apex of the strength of the movement. And even though that political side to the movement may have diminished, the number of radio stations have not. And mm-hmm. that leads me to the second point, which is you said we haven't been seeing a lot of high-profile raids and busts and things like that, like the old school, like with the Free Radio Austins and the Freak Radio Santa Cruzes and the San Francisco Liberation Radios and the Party Pirate and Lonnie Cobras in Florida, people like that. You know, we haven't seen those. You know why? Because these pirates are not explicitly making their activities political.
Right.
They're not going on the air and saying, F you, FCC. They're just going on the air and serving their local community, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so if you're not provoking the FCC directly by making one of your reasons for being contravening the law, the FCC, I think, is less likely to put a heavy hand down on you.
Mm-hmm.
It is a difference in enforcement that comes straight down to politics. The reason why the San Francisco Liberation Radios and the Freak Radio Santa Cruz get the federal marshal treatment is because they're explicitly asking for it.
And they're above ground.
They're challenging the FCC to come with what all they have.
Right.
And you have to look. Every time they've done that, has those stations gone off the air? No. Actually, just in early December, I heard from San Francisco Liberation Radio. They've been revived.
Hmm.
Finally.
Hmm. Wow.
They will be back on the air in their old neighborhood south of Market in San Francisco.
Hmm.
New blood. Someone new is going to pick up the torch, and they're going to continue the radio station. So even though the FCC sent federal marshals and San Francisco police and San Francisco Liberation Radio went through this huge court battle, which they lost, and everything like that, the station's not dead.
Right.
It hasn't gone away.
Well, and no one went to jail. No one did any time.
Nobody went to jail, and nobody's been indicted, right? And so because pirates these days, and I'm making a generalization here, pirates these days are not as explicitly political in their motive for going on the air, the FCC is handling the enforcement differently.
Mm-hmm.
And they have defaulted, I think, partially by necessity, due to the fact that they are so overwhelmed mm-hmm. with cases to fling in paper around.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's the best they can do.
It seems like
too much going on for the federal marshals and and state attorneys, you know, U.S. attorneys to deal with right now than you know, some Haitian guy running a 100-watt signal out of Miami.
It seems much more instrumental. I mean, it's exactly as you put it, serving their communities, be it the Haitian community there in South Florida or other immigrant communities in New York City. Although I know that there have been, you know, Hasidic stations in New York
absolutely,
New York City.
And you have to remember, like, Hispanic Pentecostal churches often put up radio stations.
So these aren't always who you think they are. You know, it's not, you know, it's not always the folks that you think, you know, at, you know, some grubby guys who are playing only hip hop full of F-bombs at 2 o'clock in the afternoon. It's actually quite a wide swath of the population that choose to go on the air without a license.
Absolutely. And, you know, I think I still hold to the belief that everyone who does put a radio station on the air in the United States knows they're contravening the law, because the whole act of broadcasting is technically complicated enough that you have to know enough about the law to actually do it successfully. So putting a radio station on the air means you're at least cognizant at some level that you're breaking the law.
Mm-hmm.
Now, in the olden days of the 1990s, that was the reason for putting a pirate radio station on the air, was to show that you know how to break the law and you're not afraid. In this case, people are breaking the law out of necessity, and they're kind of filing it in the back of their heads, but they're not being completely explicit about it on the air. You know, they're not hanging the skull and crossbones in their studio.
Mm-hmm.
They're not calling out the FCC and, like you said, dropping F-bombs every 20 seconds or something like that, right? They are actually, a lot of them are commercial.
Mm-hmm.
They cater to specific neighborhoods. They cater to local businesses. They program in foreign languages, you know, which are not heard on any in any other media outlet, whether it be radio, TV, or newspapers. A lot of these communities, you have to realize, are on the wrong side of the digital divide, so
mm-hmm.
they don't have internet access.
Right.
Right? What do you got left?
Mm-hmm.
You got radio. And so even though they are all cognizant of breaking the law, it's not the main motive for the majority of stations that are on the air. And we've seen over the year plenty of stations come on the air and say, we're doing it to fight the FCC. Like the last time you and I were on the air, we talked about Boulder Free Radio, KBFR, coming back on the air.
Right.
And they did an article with like an all-weekly out in the Boulder area. And they explicitly said their reason was to contravene FCC rules, but the reason why they were doing it was to bring local music back to the Boulder airwaves. You know, but at least not all pirates are as upfront about that law-breaking part. And so I think the FCC may be taking that into consideration when they're trying to handle these stations. But at the same time, there are so many damn stations out there, there's only so much the FCC can do. And like I said, they come out with their clipboards, they get their signal strength measurements, they write down the coordinates, they get the addresses, they go back, they send a certified letter, and that's about as far as everything goes. And there's no... I have seen no correlation between getting a threatening letter from the FCC and a station going off the air.
Hmm.
The FCC will claim otherwise,
mm-hmm.
but neither of us have the empirical data to prove it.
Hmm.
And who are you going to believe?
Well,
especially when you look at the data year to year and see that the enforcement activity is increasing and is weak.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we're winning. Regardless of whether or not the micro radio movement is still a movement and still considers itself in a nationally coordinated organism, which I don't think it does anymore, but as a phenomenon, as a nationwide phenomenon, it has grown and it continues to grow, and the FCC is at the red lines on the throttles. They can't go any further trying to enforce the license requirement. They're stuck.
It's interesting because I think that, as you've put it, and I agree, broadcasting without a license is a lot like adding an addition to your house without a permit.
Right.
You know, it's the point at which, you know, is that, you know, maybe getting the permit or doing other things, you know, it stands in your way too much. You know, and obviously getting a license in the United States for a broadcast station is a heck of a lot harder than getting a permit to add an addition to your house. And, you know, and at this stage of the game in the early part of the 2000s, It's significantly harder than it was 50 years prior, and even more difficult than it would have been at the dawn of radio, the dawn of even regulated radio, the dawn of the FCC.
Sure.
You know, there's been a real, snapping up and raising of the bar, taking away the ability for communities to broadcast to themselves over the course of this time, a real seismic change. And so when you're faced with the fact that going on the air with a little bit of money, a little bit of know-how is relatively easy, and the only thing that stands in your way is this piece of paper,
And the benefits outweigh the risks in your head, then you're all go.
Yeah.
You know, green light means go.
You know, indeed.
And people are doing this.
You know, and, you know, it's one of these things that you do take on risks in having to deal with the FCC and deal with the federal government in its many guises, which might be looked at as more of a hassle in a lot of ways. And it is a real danger, especially
sure,
if you're
even
in state.
The FCC comes after you. Like, for example, even if the FCC comes after you and they issue you a notice of apparent liability for $10,000, the first thing you don't lose, you don't lose your bladder control. You look at the letter and you say, what does the statute say? Well, the statute says the FCC has to take into consideration how poor I am. Now, if I am a non-English-speaking immigrant who just came fresh off the boat a couple months ago, and doesn't really have much of a job and is living with family and sets up a pirate radio station as a way to try to make some scratch and get to know the local community, the FCC looks at your tax records and sees you have no money. And so there have been lots of cases this year, for example, where a pirate has been dinged for $10,000 initially, but the final fine has been reduced to $250, you know. Or they've been hit with a $12,000 fine, and the fine has been reduced to $600. Because the FCC must take into consideration your ability to pay. And if you don't have the ability to pay, they can't hit you for $10,000.
And then you
they
pass
can't.
Off. And yeah, unlike, you know,
and
getting fined for other things.
How hard is it for you to go around your community and collect $250 in fine?
Yeah. And you pass know? Off the transmitter to somebody else.
And the cycle continues.
It's fascinating.
That's the way it works. It's great. It's a good time to be a pirate. Right.
And not that we are necessarily, at least not that I am necessarily encouraging people to do so, but it's good, you know, just to understand what the implications are, what the dynamics are, what the true risks are versus what people might fear, thinking they're going to get chased through the brush. By large Jeeps and vans marked FCC, as they've seen in the movies.
It just ain't gonna happen, brother. It ain't gonna happen.
Well, John, all this data is online at your website,
DIYmedia.net.
And
I just published a summary of the enforcement activity as I've broken it down for you on air. So if people want to go to the site and read it, it's the top story on the front page right now. And there are links to all of the data, so if you want to look through the numbers and compare year to year and whatever, you're more than welcome to.
So it's all at DIYmedia.net, and the enforcement action database is listed there on the left. John, once again, thank you for joining me for another year interview.
It's always a pleasure, Paul.
I'm glad you're there, and I know you'll be keeping up. And there's so many things we didn't even get to, like digital radio and some other issues, which I hope we'll have a chance to speak about real soon.
Oh, we'll get a whole other show out of that.
We will. All right, well, let's look forward to a good 2009 then.
Amen.
All right, and this has been the Media Geek Radio Show. I'll be back in one more week with more news and views of our media environment. In the meantime, go to MediaGeek.net online, where you can catch the Media Geek blog. And, of course, the radio show is at radio.mediageek.net. You can subscribe to the podcast, download MP3s, or listen right in your browser. If in case you missed it, or that's the way you want to listen, radio.mediageek.net. If you have any comments about the program, I'd love to hear them. Send them to me, paul@mediageek.net. You are listening to WNUR-FM, Evanston, Chicago, at 89.3 FM, Chicago Sound Experiment. Stay tuned for Street Beat and the Part-Time Suckers.
All right. Let's get started. You may learn something.
New Year's. It's 2009 now. Doesn't really feel any different so far. I think 2008 was alright. I think you've done some damage to your ears, which is the proof of that. My name is G Coos. This is Part Time Sucker Radio on the first day of the new year. And due to the fact that I was entertaining folks last night late, I wasn't in the mood to really get too creative, so I'm going to play the set that I played last night, or most of it, or parts of it, or something like that. But I think it was decent, and people enjoyed it, and only a limited amount of you heard it, so this way everybody will get to hear it. There's some fine music in it, some new producers, new to me. New stuff that's not out yet, probably. Some of it may be out. Out to Whittler, which is one of those folks. I'm very, very pleased with his music. Anyway, enough talking. WNORDJ on Instant Messenger is the way you can get a hold of me here. 847-866-WNUR. 847-866-9687 is the phone number. I'm here by myself, so if you call, I might not be able to get to you right away. Thank you all for listening. There is an event coming up, actually, this Friday. The DOC. Borgia. And I don't have the stuff handy in front of me, so I can't tell you everybody else, but the DOC and Borgia for sure. Now GC, I think, at Lava this Friday, Bass Coast Boom event. Go to bassboom.com, get all your details there. I think it's $5 at the door, $7 at the door, something like that. Also, the 14th of January, M50 of Etc. Radio here on WNUR alongside myself and Cringer at Lava, a Dubfront special seminar. So those are things to check. And that's that. Thanks for tuning in. My name is G Coos. I'm going to bring it to you tonight.